This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 28, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Pakistani clerics pull out of a meeting with the Taliban. The Reverend Jesse Jackson continues to ponder his decision to accept an invitation to meet with the Muslim organization. And India cracks down on extremist Muslim groups in its borders. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Jakarta, Indonesia, some 2,000 Muslim students marched in the largest anti-Western protest in years, rallying against a potential U.S.-led attack in Afghanistan. Meantime, when President Bush met with the Indonesian president last week, he proposed a waiver on restrictions imposed on the Indonesian military by U.S. policy. John Miller of the East Timor Action Network.
Our concern is, one, that any restoration of ties sends a really wrong signal to the Indonesian military, which has yet to improve its behavior, yet to be held accountable for human rights violations in East Timor or in Indonesia itself, and that this, again, just represents a step in a longer-term plan to fully restore military ties with the Indonesians.
U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California wants to impose a six-month moratorium on student visas. Aaron Glantz reports from Berkeley.
Senator Feinstein said she introduced the legislation after learning that one of the suspected airline hijackers entered the U.S. on a student visa. The suspect got the visa after promising to enroll in November at ELS Language Center. He never showed up. If adopted, Feinstein's proposal would keep more than 500,000 international students from attending U.S. colleges and universities. Immigrant rights groups call Feinstein's proposal xenophobic. The president of the American Council on Education, a national organization of college presidents, says Feinstein's proposal would have a, quote, very disturbing effect on higher education in America. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz at UC Berkeley.
A Palestinian-born professor who had in the past been investigated by the FBI for alleged ties to terrorists is being put on paid leave by the University of South Florida. The move came just 36 hours after the professor was grilled on the Fox News program, The O'Reilly Factor. Free Speech Radio's Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
Sami Al-Arian is the former head of the World in Islam Studies Enterprise, a now-defunct Islamic think tank located on the University of South Florida campus. FBI agents raided their offices in 1995 and froze its assets. But Al-Arian was never charged by the FBI or detained. But on Wednesday night, Fox News' Bill O'Reilly said there was enough circumstantial evidence to link Al-Arian to suspected terrorists. Al-Arian said he was set up by O'Reilly.
I mean, this guy was not interested in the truth. He was not interested to know what's going on. He was not interested to understand the mission of the research institution or the USF relationship. None of that. He was interested in boosting his ratings and inciting people against innocent people, against us.
The university says they received numerous phone calls asking if they were harboring terrorism at the school. And in an emergency meeting this morning, they announced they were suspending with pay the professor, pending an internal investigation. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani has proffered a plan for retaining his post a bit longer. Miranda Kennedy has the particulars from New York.
In private meetings with the three New York mayoral candidates yesterday, current New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani told the candidates that if they did not let him stay in office another 3 months, he would seek re-election on the Conservative Party ballot. Giuliani, who is legally prevented from running for a third term in office, needs a last-minute legislative repeal of term limits in order to be able to run. But yesterday, Michael Bloomberg, the Republican candidate, and Mark Green, one of the Democratic candidates, announced they would support the proposal to extend Giuliani's term by 3 months. But Fernando Ferrer, who will face Green in a Democratic runoff in 2 weeks, said he did not support the proposal. While politicians across the city agree he has dealt with the events heroically, they also say he is creating uncertainty about the future of city government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New York.
The World Bank and the IMF may have canceled their meetings in Washington this week, but some of those who march for global justice have not. Randy Zimmerman is in Washington.
While events have been scaled back considerably from the expected 100,000 to maybe 10,000, those who fight for global justice feel a deeper sense of commitment and urgency as the rhetoric of war permeates throughout the country and the U.S. flexes military muscles in the Mideast. Steve Schafferman, an organizer with the Mobilization for Global Justice and the People's Summit, explains.
Well, even though the IMF and World Bank canceled their meetings, the institutions continue, their structural adjustment policies continue, and people around the world are dying of hunger and preventable diseases.
The larger protest was canceled by the 11-member coalition, which included the AFL-CIO, the Feminist Majority, and Friends of the Earth, because they felt the public was still not ready to cope with the tough issues in the shadow of the September 11th disaster. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Randy Zimmerman in D.C.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
A delegation of Pakistani religious clerics has ended a visit to Taliban leaders in Afghanistan in a last-minute bid to try to avert U.S. attacks. Meanwhile, the United Nations said today that up to 8 million Afghans will be in dire need of assistance as a result of the current crisis. Jeremy Scahill reports.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says the world body needs more than $500 million in aid to address what it has already declared a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. Already, Afghanis constitute the world's largest refugee population, and Kofi Annan says that even a large sum of money may be inadequate to head off the worst-case scenario, given that the UN has not been on the ground in Afghanistan for weeks.
We pulled out most of our humanitarian workers, and in fact, we are talking of getting back getting in supplies, but we would also need to get in the humanitarian workers.
A delegation of Pakistani religious leaders has wrapped up a visit to the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar. They were accompanied on the trip by the head of Pakistan's intelligence service, which played a key role in the Taliban's rise to power. The visit was considered an 11th-hour attempt to head off the inevitable, but there is talk of the delegation returning this weekend for another round of discussions. Historical allies of the Taliban say there is little chance of success in convincing the group to hand over Osama bin Laden. Hamid Karazi of the Pakistani opposition in Islamabad says he doesn't believe the group's spiritual leader, Mullah Mohammed Omar, understands the gravity of the situation.
Well, I don't think he understands what's at stake. I don't think he even is fully aware of what's going on in the world. He doesn't even, I believe, understand the consequences of this for the Afghan people, and that's the real dilemma.
USA Today is reporting that elite U.S. Special Operations Forces have been inside Afghanistan the past 2 weeks, looking for Osama bin Laden. But the paper says they are having difficulty locating him. Today, President Bush met with Jordan's King Abdullah at the White House and once again implied that covert actions are very much on the table.
It is very hard to fight a conventional war, a guerrilla war with conventional forces. And we understand that. That's why I have explained to the American people that the new war on terror is going to be a different war. It'll be fought on a variety of fronts. There may or may not be a conventional component to it. I said loud and clear, sometimes people will be able to see what we do on the television screens. Other times, the American people won't be able to see what we're doing. But make no mistake about it, we're in hot pursuit.
There are reports out of Saudi Arabia today that the government has now offered Washington the use of its territory to launch attacks against Afghanistan, a move which brings the prospect of war even closer. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson continues to weigh what he says is an invitation from the Taliban to meet with the Muslim clerics associated with terrorist Osama bin Laden. Jackson says he wants to try to gain the release of 8 Christian missionaries jailed in Afghanistan and convince the Taliban to turn over bin Laden. But the Taliban reportedly says it never extended an invitation to Jackson. This morning on Good Morning America, Jackson recounted the initial telephone call from the clerics requesting that a delegation come to Afghanistan. And Jackson quipped, "I certainly didn't call 1-800 Taliban." And in an address to the media this afternoon, Jackson reminded other religious leaders that they too have a role to play in this scenario.
Global religious leaders of conscience have a role to play in this. We must not underestimate, because Taliban is a government, but the Afghanistan people, those people and their pain must register deeply in our consciousness. They must see us as their friends. They must not see us as the ones with the fastest planes and biggest bombs, but the one with the most food and medicine and health care. honoring their quest for self-determination. If we choose that method of operation, we're going to win this victory, but in the byproduct, gain victors around the world.
Jackson has pulled off a string of diplomatic successes in the Middle East, including the freeing of an American flyer who was downed over Syria and taken captive. Joe Madison is a radio talk show host and political activist and an associate of Reverend Jackson. He believes Jackson may have valuable assets in this instance. We caught up with Madison at the Congressional Black Caucus Convention in Washington, D.C.
If I were Reverend Jackson, one of the first persons I'd take with me would be people like Farrakhan, Wallace D. Muhammad. I'd call on Nelson Mandela and Becky, because these are people who have relationships with the very people we're trying to negotiate with now. Where it was Arab countries, for example, that supported the ANC during the days of their anti-apartheid movement. I see a lot of partisanship, but I do not see a lot of sharing of leadership.
But others are less optimistic about Jackson's influence in this tenuous situation.
Well, like chicken soup, I don't think that it will necessarily hurt if Reverend Jackson decides to go to Central Asia.
Gerald Horn is a professor of African American affairs at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
However, I think that there is a missing step, and this is something that Reverend Jackson may want to take under advisement. That is to say, he should ask the Bush administration and or the State Department to provide some sort of white paper, as Colin Powell suggested this past Sunday, laying out the case with regard to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden being responsible for the tragedies of September 11th. My understanding is that Reverend Jackson is going to Central Asia in order to try to arrange for the turning over of Mr. bin Laden to the U.S. authorities. Well, it seems to me that a conditioned precedent to Mr. bin Laden being turned over is some sort of evidence that he was in fact responsible, and I think that that would be necessary as well for the international community, not only for Reverend Jackson's trip, and not only for the international community, but also for the United States people as a whole, who, of course, are being driven to the brink of war.
You said earlier that, like chicken soup, it won't hurt to have Reverend Jackson go in, but will it help, given his track record in the past?
Will it help? It depends. Will it help what? I mean,
can it actually, do you think that he stands a good chance of being able to move this world from the brink of war, this country, at least at any rate, and given his past history of being able to go in and negotiate in some difficult situations, do you hold out any hope that this might actually be a good idea?
My understanding is that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, Mr. bin Laden's organization, are quite close, and that in fact there have been questions raised as to who is the puppet and who is the puppet master. In other words, some are suggesting that Mr. bin Laden and Al-Qaeda are really in charge in Kabul. If that is the case, it's difficult for me to imagine that the Taliban will be turning over Mr. bin Laden to Reverend Jackson or anyone else. My understanding is, in fact, that there are marital ties between Mr. bin Laden's family and Mullah Omar, the top leader in Kabul. So given all of that, I'm not optimistic about Mr. Jackson returning to Washington with Mr. bin Laden in tow.
Well, I'm thinking that if perhaps there is an opportunity for some sort of different outcome to this situation other than short of turning over bin Laden and short of going to war, that Reverend Jackson might be able to negotiate.
Well, it's interesting. You might recall that the Taliban offered to have talks with the Bush administration about this crisis, and the Bush administration rejected the opportunity for same. Their invitation to Reverend Jackson indicates that they are perhaps seeing this as a proxy for talks with the Bush administration. But as you know, both the Bush administration and the State Department have suggested that Mr. Jackson is not carrying a brief for them, that he is on his own. And so, therefore, I would assume that Mr. Jackson will be just negotiating on behalf of himself or perhaps Rainbow Push Coalition, And certainly it's hard for me to imagine that he could deliver the U.S. administration.
It doesn't sound like you hold out much hope for that.
Well, it's just the dynamics. It seems that the Bush administration is filled with bloodlust right now. And it seems that a significant portion of the U.S. population also is seeking revenge right now for the 6,000 plus who were murdered as a result of these tragedies on September 11th. It seems as well that the Bush administration is hell-bent on replacing the Taliban, admonitions to the contrary notwithstanding. So given all of that, and given the fact that the Congressional Black Caucus, which we would traditionally look to for leadership in Congress on matters of peace, has basically taken a dive, one just has to make a realistic assessment right now that Mr. Jackson's trip does not look like it will be bringing back any kind of good news, although one can always be hopeful and one can always be optimistic.
Gerald Horn, professor of African and African-American studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jamaica's Prime Minister P.J. Patterson has announced what he calls an across-the-board bailout of his country's tourist industry, which is reeling after this month's attacks on New York and Washington. The plan outlined yesterday in Kingston gives millions of dollars in tax breaks and direct subsidies to Jamaica's hotel and airline companies. But as Patrick Scudder reports from Jamaica's North Coast, small business people are being left out in the cold.
A woman craft vendor in the resort town of Ocheria says fewer tourists have been coming into the market since the terrorist attacks in the U.S. 2 weeks ago. And to make matters worse, the few that come don't spend a lot of money because of fears of an American recession.
Because I was talking to a lady this morning, and she said, you know, her company, they're firing a lot of people and so laying off rather, she said. So she's not sure she's going to have her job when she goes back.
She says if this negative trend continues, she will be forced to go out of business.
Every day I come from last week, especially from last week, I haven't sold nothing.
She says her husband has been forced to bear all the costs for sending their four children to school, but they get help from family members. This woman is just one of the 300 vendors in the largest craft market on the main street in Ocheria's. All the vendors are so badly affected that they ask for spare change to get on a bus for home. Craft vendors can make up to $250 each day, but that has dried up after September 11. Prime Minister P.J. Patterson says hoteliers will get tax breaks and Air Jamaica will get millions of dollars worth of short-term accident indemnity because insurance companies move to cap their risk against third-party accidents. But no assistance was announced for micro-business people in the tourist trade. Their local political representatives have no plans to help them. So one can assume that if this crisis escalates, many ordinary Jamaicans who make a living on tourism will just be forced out of business. Patrick Scudder in Ocheria's Jamaica for Free Speech Radio News.
In the first crackdown on extremist Muslim groups since the September 11th attacks on the United States, the Indian government has banned the Student Islamic Movement of India, or SIMI, and a number of Kashmiri militant groups. The move sparked violent protests in the northern city of Lucknow, during which at least five people were killed. In this report from Bombay, Sputnik Kalambi looks at how Indian Muslims feel about the U.S. war on terrorism.
Muhammad Ali Road, a central artery in Bombay and predominantly Muslim. Congested, noisy, this is an area where people live cheek by jowl. Even the buildings look like they might collapse under the weight of this teeming humanity. The area has bitter memories of the 1992-1993 riots when the Hindu supremacist party, the Shiv Sena, with tacit police support, went on the rampage against Muslims. Muhammad Ali Road is once again thriving, but it remains a tinderbox. Feelings run high here about the U.S. response to the events in New York and Washington. There are warnings, too, to the Indian government about how its 120 million-strong Muslim population feels about its unqualified support to Washington's declaration of war against terrorism. Daud Khan heads the Aman Committee, a group formed in the wake of the last riots to promote harmony between Hindus and Muslims.
The person who has been killed in America, we are all sympathy, our solidarity with them. But we wanted that America should also consider why the attack had been done on this city. If they are having any evidence, if they are having any proof, if they are having any ground, so they should brought in the notice of the world so they will have a sympathy with them without giving any ground and justification or evidence. They are only claiming that America, Osama bin Laden is guilty, he is terrorist. I don't think that the world will accept.
Arshad Rahman is doing brisk business selling blankets despite the unusually hot and sultry weather. For him, it's clear that the United States brought the September 11th attacks upon itself.
If there is an attack, there will be repercussions all over the world, not just in India. America should not hit back, because it was America that gave birth to Osama bin Laden and made him a revolutionary against the Russians. The Taliban were also created by the Americans and used by them. Now, after what happened and what he's believed to have done, they call him a terrorist. But he's not a terrorist. He's a true leader of the Muslim people worldwide. What he did for the Muslim community. Everybody looks after the rich, but who speaks up for the poor?
India's offer of unreserved support to the United States has no takers here. This was the reaction of a slave mentality, according to many people. Noorun Nisa is a school teacher. India, she says, should not get involved.
There is absolutely no cause for India to interfere at all. America has asked for help from Pakistan. Even people in high places like Kalyan Singh and other politicians have said India should not interfere. If they ask you for help, then you should consider it. They've asked Pakistan, so let Pakistan help. Why should we get our oars in?
Fareed Ansari agrees. He condemns the loss of innocent life in the attacks, but says India has no business getting mixed up in this, since it will spark anger at home.
Many ministers have said that you can use our airbase, you can take fuel from us, we'll help you, we can find out who has done it. So it shows that it is they are singling out the community and they are provoking the feelings of the other community, that is Muslim especially. You know, all not Muslim are well educated and not they are intellectual. So they are waiting for any street scene. So somebody will come mob and they'll start firing because they are waiting to just kill the innocent people.
Violence has already erupted in India. In the northern city of Lucknow, at least 5 people were killed and several others injured yesterday when police opened fire on demonstrators protesting against the ban on the Students' Islamic Movement of India. Dozens of Simi activists have been arrested countrywide. The two largest political parties, the ruling BJP and the Congress, have welcomed the ban. But others say it should also apply to extremist Hindu outfits, such as the Vishwa Hindu Parishad and the Bajrang Dal. For Daud Khan, the move against Simi smacks of double standards.
Bajrang Dal should also be banned. The destruction are there, some ground are there. And this ground is not just now. They are giving training to their person since last 10 years. They are banning the Simi. The same yardstick should be given to the Bajrang Dal also. So the people of the country will say that justice is there, fairness is there, honesty is there, sincerity is there in our country.
If Simi is a terrorist organization, says Arshad Rahman, one needs to question the roots of terrorism.
I'm an Indian, and I think India should look after its Muslims. Look at the number of attacks the Israelis launch against Palestinians, and the whole world is silent. And in the case of Kashmir, too, you need to ask why there is terrorism there. Who gives birth to terrorism? Why does a man begin to struggle? Because his rights are denied to him. Does that make him a terrorist? I say no. I say that Israel is the real terrorist. America is the real terrorist.
I'm Sputnik Kilambi in Bombay for Free Speech Radio News.
Australia has sent troops to participate in nearly every U.S. war since World War II. Australian troops have fought and died alongside American troops in Vietnam, Korea, Panama, and the Gulf War. And now the Australian military is on high alert, with troops and ships ready to depart for Afghanistan. Rachel Meyer reports from Melbourne.
In the wake of the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, Australia's Prime Minister John Howard pledged full military support for the Bush administration's planned retaliation, putting Australian Defence Forces on high alert and waiting for the call to action from America. The enthusiasm with which the Australian government lends military support to America has a 50-year history, as Jacob Greck from the Action for Peace Alliance explains.
Well, Australia, I think, still feels out of place as a white first world English-speaking nation in the Asia-Pacific region. And prior to the Second World War, we basically had our allegiances to Mother Britain, and rather than ensuring any kind of independence, what we did at the end of the Second World War was transfer our allegiance to Father America rather than Mother England. Australia often basically places its allegiance and pledges military support and makes foreign policy decisions which are against its own interests and to the interests of the ruling superpower. We've done this, we were the first people to put our hands up in Korea, we were the first people in Vietnam to say, can we come along too? In Iraq, the Australian government, under a Labor government, put its hand up and said, please, can we come too? We're doing it again now.
However, Australia's military support goes far beyond political rhetoric. And if America goes to war, as George Bush promises, Australian troops will be dispatched immediately. Peace activist and former Australian Senator Joe Valentine.
We build our military capabilities to suit the United States military machine. We have to have what they call interoperability, which means that our forces can quickly work with their forces at a moment's notice, which is exactly what's happening now. There are evidently 150 Australian military personnel in both the UK and the United States at the moment on exchange programs and the like, and of course then they get absorbed straight into the forces of those countries. So our interoperability is complete to the extent of people being able to slot straight into their forces, as well as our equipment being able to work with their equipment.
Australia, as a defence partner of the United States, also supplies military intelligence through the joint facility at Pine Gap, thereby entrenching Australia's role in fighting America's wars. Jacob Grech, again, from the Action for Peace Alliance.
And as well as sending troops, we've got to stress that an important part of this relationship is our hosting of foreign military bases such as Pine Gap and Kojarima, because regardless of how many troops we send to fight this war, the important role we'll be playing will be as the Command, Control, Communications and Intelligence Centre.
Australian peace activists are as vigilant as their American counterparts, and as Joe Valentine concludes, as a result of this recent terrorist attack on America, there is an even greater urgency for understanding.
Behind every terrorist there is injustice. We've got to look at why people were so desperate and so committed to their cause, in which they obviously believed absolutely that they were prepared to fly aeroplanes into huge buildings on an ordinary work day a couple of weeks ago. It's a most extraordinary event and of utmost significance in the way the world progresses in its development or lack of development. So I think that we've got to keep saying to our politicians, this is a chance for the world to really begin to see things differently, to treat each other differently, and it actually comes back to each individual person. I mean, if we're harbouring hate for anybody or anything, we should really look at that, because it does come down to individuals feeling that way that allows movements to gather steam and build up momentum to the extent that they are able to produce people who will do dreadful things. Now, I would say that the military in our culture and our government does exactly the same sort of thing. It's government-licensed killing in a war as opposed to terrorism. Both result in the same thing, a lot of dead people and a lot of heartache.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and 4 continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 1-510-287-5551. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Padgett-Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown.